Welcome to The Brink, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
The company Nintendo had been around for nearly a century when it became clear it was time to take a big gamble.
The card company had been dealt a bad hand, and the industry it dominated was fading from popularity.
And so, Nintendo did a bit of a shuffle and backed a new horse.
Who just happened to be a gorilla, named after a donkey. This is Nintendo on the Brink. Hi, everybody. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Ariel Kasten.
Ariel, did you ever own a Nintendo system?
I didn't own one growing up, but I do own some version of them now.
Yeah, same here. I am old enough where I grew up with the Atari 2600.
Mm-hmm. I also have an Atari.
Yeah, I grew up with it. And I was there when it came out.
And show off.
Then, yeah, congrats on not dying, Jonathan. And the Nintendo, by the time it came out, I was getting to a point where I was not into console video games. I'd switched over to computer video mm-hmm. games. But these days, I do own a Nintendo. Actually, the only console I currently have at my entertainment system that is a Nintendo one is the Wii. I don't have a Wii U. I don't have a Switch. I do have somewhere a Nintendo 64 and a Nintendo GameCube, but they are not hooked up to anything.
I still kind of want a Wii. I like the sports. I like being able to stand in front of my computer and do some sort of minimal workout.
Where you feel like you're making some sort of progress.
Like the balance board. The balance board actually kicked my butt once or twice.
Yeah, that was one of those peripherals that really took off. Now, the reason why I even ask you this question is that kind of this quick conversation we're having already illustrates how we tie the identity of Nintendo to the industry of home video games. But in fact, the company has been around long before there were video games.
That's right. Nintendo has been around since 1889.
Yeah, so more than 100 years now. But at the time of the debut of the Nintendo Entertainment System, which is really what this show is mostly about, it wasn't quite a century old at that point. But I'm assuming there were no 19th century video game consoles, what with the lack of televisions and all.
Yeah.
So what was Nintendo doing?
Well, they were making playing cards, but not Western playing cards like we think of. They were making Japanese playing cards or Hanafuda cards.
Mm-hmm.
They had flowers on them. There were some regular cards and then some specialty cards, and you could play a bunch of different games with them. And Fusajiro Yamamochi started making them in Kyoto, Japan, and their clientele was largely gambling houses.
Yeah, so this was a company that has its origins in gambling. These cards could be incredibly ornate, right? Mm-hmm. Like they were made from tree bark in the early days of the industry.
Yeah, and they were all handmade at the beginning of
These were not the same thing as you would find in a playing deck of Western cards, like a poker deck.
Yeah, I actually have it later in our notes, but it's a good time to bring it up. Western playing cards had been banned in Japan since the 16th century at this time.
Yeah, Japan has long had a history of trying to kind of insulate itself mm-hmm. from the outside world. I mean, throughout its history for many, many centuries, that was kind of the leading philosophy in Japan. So when Nintendo first started, it was actually called Nintendo Koppai, and it was named after the actual gambling establishments that were using the cards that it was selling.
Translations of the name go anywhere from Luck Heaven Hall to In the End, It's in Heaven's Hands, which is from gambling. There are some different variations on what it could mean. They're all approximate translations.
So essentially saying things like, the outcome depends upon luck.
Yeah, but The Examiner did an article on the history of Nintendo, and there it states that the kanji symbols for the name Nintendo might be as literal as to mean the temple of free Hanafuda or the company that is allowed to make or sell Hanafuda. So
it's a very, very kind of bureaucratic name.
Yeah, at which point Nintendo doesn't fit what they do anymore. Well, no, it does. They still make cards.
Right, that's true, especially when you talk about things like the 3DS. But anyway, mm-hmm. the company was doing well. It was selling those cards, and That was a profitable business. And so they began to expand throughout the nation of Japan.
Yeah. And then somewhere between 1902 and 1907, they started making Western playing cards. Now, other companies had tried to start to reintroduce them, but they were the first successful company to do so. Mm-hmm. And then they started distributing them in tobacco shops, like cigarette shops.
Yeah. So at this point, Nintendo is catering to an adult audience. They are not at all aimed at kids. The cards were not for kids' games. These were for, you know, it was
for
like
the Yakuza.
Yeah. It was like poker. I mean, it was like, while we have poker cards and we use them for games that kids can play, this was largely considered, this is the world of gambling and mm-hmm. adult activity. Not anything what we would associate Nintendo with today.
Now, around this time, around the early 1900s, Fusajiro had a daughter, mm-hmm. Tei, and she marries a guy named Sekiryo. And I am sorry, I tried to look up pronunciations of all these names. I don't speak Japanese, so even with the pronunciation guide in front of me, I still might be mispronouncing them.
Right. Yeah. Well, we will do our best. But yes, keep in mind that our Western pronunciations, we understand how terrible they are.
So they get married, they have a daughter, and then in 1927, their daughter has a child, Hiroshi, and when he was five, he went to live with his grandparents. And that seems like it's not important, but it becomes very important later on in Nintendo's history.
Yeah, just spoiler alert, Nintendo was very much a family business for a very, very long mm-hmm. time. So 1929, Fusajiro retires, Sekiryo becomes Nintendo's second president. So he's the second Yamauchi president, mm-hmm. in belonging to the family Yamauchi. And Nintendo Kōpai was the largest playing card company in Japan at that time. So the company's doing very well in the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm. And then in the early 1930s, they become Yamauchi Nintendo & Co. instead of Nintendo Kōpai. Mm-hmm. Which makes sense because it's a family business. And they moved into a new headquarters. They were doing really well. They added assembly lines for production so they could up that. And then they started outsourcing their paper supplies as well, mm-hmm. just to further bank on their output.
And they continue expanding by building out a distribution company for their Western playing card decks mm-hmm. Called Marufuku Company Limited.
Yes. Now, in 1949, Sekiryo had a stroke, and he called Hiroshi in, his grandson, and he said, "I want to make you the president of Yamauchi Nintendo." Mm-hmm. And at the time, Hiroshi was only 22. He had been married for a few years, and some accounts say he was even still in school. Mm-hmm. But he accepts, and so he becomes president in 1950. And interestingly, he was worried that because he was so young and because he was brought in because he was family more so than necessarily based on his achievements, that the existing employees of the company wouldn't take him seriously. And so he fired anyone who didn't support him, including his own family. But he got permission to do it first. He said, "I want to fire anybody who's not 100% behind me so that I can establish my
dominance."
My dominance. That's a horrible way to
it's
put
a
it.
Very, but. But you already mentioned Yakuza. This comes across to me as very sort of organized crime family approach.
Nintendo Kōpai cards were used in a lot of Yakuza establishments.
Well, it also, by the way, this isn't really going to play in this discussion about Nintendo very much, but it is something interesting that I learned while we were doing research on the subject. Did you come across the idea of the loud American
I didn't.
Job? So,
no, tell me.
A lot of Japanese companies will hire an American to be on staff. The American is frequently referred to as the loud American. Uh-huh. The loud American's job is to speak up whenever he or she feels that the head of the company is making a poor decision. Because in Japanese culture, it is considered impolite. It is a social faux pas to speak against your boss, to disagree with what your boss says. What you are supposed to do is fall in line with whatever the boss wants, even if you feel in your heart of hearts that this is the wrong direction for the company to go in. The cultural pressure is to agree. So a lot of Japanese companies would literally hire Americans
wow.
because they were known to be opinionated and speak out against a superior if they disagreed with that superior,
wow.
something that, that a lot of the Japanese felt they could not do.
Now, you see, like, I am very opinionated, but I would get so much anxiety doing that job.
Whereas I'm sitting there thinking, like, maybe I need to update my resume and see if any Japanese companies need a loud American, because I could totally do that
you
job.
You can be pretty loud.
Yeah, well, that's true.
To get back to the history of
yes.
Nintendo, in 1951, Hiroshi changed the name of the company to the Nintendo Playing Cards Company Limited.
Right. And then the 1952, they moved to new headquarters, larger and pretty HQ. They also started to consolidate their manufacturing facilities.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 1953, they did something else that other card companies had been trying to do in Japan and not succeeding in. They started plastic coating their playing cards.
Yeah, it makes them longer lasting, easier
yeah.
to use. And a lot of companies have been trying to do it, but had not quite mastered the manufacturing process. And so they were getting
yeah.
lots of errors. So Nintendo was the first one to do this on a practical manufacturing scale.
One of the things that Nintendo had been focusing on throughout this time was a strong distribution setup.
Yeah.
And so strong production and strong distribution really allowed them to do this successfully.
Now, one problem with making plastic-coated playing cards is that those playing cards do last longer,
mm-hmm.
which means that if people are taking care of their stuff, they don't need to buy your stuff as frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that you also may need to identify potential new markets you can sell to. And if you're just keeping yourself to the seedy underworld of gambling and Yakuza, then maybe you got to figure out some way of opening that up to people who normally wouldn't be found in gambling halls. And so Nintendo makes a clever decision, and they mm-hmm. reach out to get a licensing agreement with another company, a big, big, big company that was known for its masterwork in marketing. And that would be
Disney.
Yeah. So they were able to get licensing for Disney-themed cards, which meant that they could now sell these cards to a totally new audience, kids.
Yeah, they distributed them through toy companies and department stores, and they sold over 600,000 packs the year they made this deal and produced them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even though they expanded their demographic to kids, in my opinion, they didn't realize the power of opening up their business to children quite as much as they ought to right away.
They had not yet started to really consider diversification.
Mm-hmm.
But the requirement to go with this licensing agreement was sort of the writing on the wall, this idea that the company was eventually going to have to think about doing something else
mm-hmm.
because they'd grown about as much as they could grow as a playing card company. It would go on a little bit longer. And in fact,
yeah.
the pressure to grow would become even more intense in 1962 because
they went public.
Yep.
Now, they went public in Japan, I believe, in two different exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
And it went well for a little bit. And then in 1963, their stock dropped because they hit market saturation again.
Yeah. So now, you know, you've got investors. The investors expect a return on their investment. That's why people invest, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that they're going to make more money by investing in this company. But when you hit market saturation and you're finding it harder and harder to sell your product, it you can't really grow. So this was forcing Nintendo to think outside of the playing card industry.
Yeah. And so they started making changes.
Yeah, they made some pretty extreme changes,
mm-hmm.
and they tried a whole bunch of stuff. Tell me about some of the businesses Nintendo tried its hand at in this period.
Well, first I'm going to say, as they're delving into these other businesses, change your name from Nintendo Playing Cards to just Nintendo Company.
Which is part of the indication that they're looking into other businesses, not just playing cards.
Yeah, and then they tried to make a TV station, a taxi company.
Mm-hmm.
The taxi company went okay, but making all of the deals and contracts with all the taxi drivers proved to be too tedious, so that didn't last long.
It was a lot of work for very little return.
They tried to make individual serving instant rice, so they tried to compete in the ramen noodle market.
Yeah, that didn't go over so great.
Nope. And then they made love hotels.
Yeah, what's a love hotel, Ariel? Is it a hotel that gives you a Valentine when you show up?
You could say that, Jonathan. A love hotel is pretty much exactly what it sounds like.
It's a place you go if romance is in the air.
Or romance adjacent things.
Yeah. So I've known this story for a while. I've covered Nintendo on a different podcast a few times. So I had read all about the history before we started doing this podcast, but I remember how shocking it was to me.
Yeah.
Because again, throughout my lifetime, the name Nintendo has always been associated with arcade and video games. Mm-hmm. Not a place where you would bring your little bit on the side for a roll in the hay.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, that did not last very long either. No. I mean, the business did not last very long either. I'm not trying to comment on the activities that went on inside the Love Hotel.
Well, listen, they also started making toys. I'm just going to get us back on track here.
All right. No.
They also started making toys at this time. It wasn't really helping as much as they needed. They had a lot of debt from the stock drop.
And all these failed businesses.
They did have a turnaround. I guess it's kind of a toy, but it kind of goes back to the gambling with an extendable arm called the Ultra Hand.
Yeah, this was something that one of the engineers in Nintendo was sort of playing around with. And it was one of those things where the executive saw the possibility of marketing this as a product.
It kind of helped them dam the leak a little bit.
Yeah, but this was not, they didn't immediately jump into toys at that point. Mm-mm. Not even yet. They were still, it was kind of like another one of these, let's try this crazy idea approach.
Yeah. Now, in the late 1960s, they made a partnership with Sharp.
Yeah, the electronics company.
And then they started moving into the electronic toy market.
Which was brand new in Japan.
Yeah.
That was not something that had really existed. Japan had lagged behind America at that point. And of course, we all know that once it started taking off in Japan, that story changed dramatically. They became leaders in that space.
Nintendo, once again, was one of the first successful companies to do this.
Yeah. And what was the toy that they first started making with Sharp?
Well, first they made a beam gun.
Yeah, a light beam gun. So it has a little light sensor and it can shoot a beam out and catch the reflection.
And make targets explode.
Yeah. And they also, that wasn't the only thing they came out with. They came out with something else.
A love tester. They can't let go of this love matchmaking concept, can they?
Well, it's just because Nintendo wants to see people happy.
It was just a little toy that told you if you're compatible with the other person playing with the toy.
I think it was probably less salacious than the love hotels.
That's what I was trying to say.
So then they were able to establish this early burgeoning business in Japan. Really, that started to establish itself in 1970.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, things were starting to look a little more bright on the horizon for Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. They changed their listing in the stock market now that they're focusing more on electronic toys. Mm-hmm. They improved their headquarters. They did a company restructuring. But this time it was because things were starting to look up, not necessarily because they had hit a brink and needed to cut everybody. They just wanted to make sure that their business structure would support their new endeavors.
Right.
Now that they found something that seemed to be going well.
And this leads us up to the real brink moment for Nintendo, where they would find their true future, at least for the next few decades. It brings us up to the dawn of the arcade age. But before we get into that, let's take a quick break. All right, so Nintendo had done the playing card thing, still was. It wasn't like they had abandoned playing cards entirely. They had done some toys, and they were starting to see the opportunity to get into electronic games, largely for entertainment venues, not for the home use.
Yeah. So stuff like bowling alleys.
Yeah, that was one of the first things they were thinking about was what can we make that an entertainment establishment could purchase? Like, so it'd be a big ticket item, But then they would sell, it'd be like a coin-operated game or something along those lines. And the first one that they really came out with was another light beam gun game. It was a simulated clay pigeon shooter, and it had a projector and the light gun. The projector would project images of the clay pigeons, and you would use your little light gun to shoot the clay pigeons, and if it registered a shot, then you would get points. I've actually seen these sort of things in arcades not that long ago.
Yeah.
Now, I remember, I think there was a Dave & Buster's that had something very similar to this. Now, this was obviously a very early version of this technology.
Well, throughout Nintendo's history and into the video game market, you can just see all of these iterations of what eventually becomes Duck Hunt, and I love it. So first they have the beam gun, and now they have this clay pigeon shooter, and then they'll have more later on.
Right. They also managed to secure the rights to be the distributor in Japan for the Magnavox Odyssey game system, which was essentially a game system that ran different versions of Pong. That would become a thing for a long time. Like a lot of home systems early on were Pong systems.
So I recently went up to New Hampshire and I went to the Big Big Arcade up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I played an original Pong console.
Yeah.
Except for it was slightly off center. And it's a lot harder to play Pong when the screen is slightly off center.
Yeah, I had, I don't think it was an Odyssey. It might have been an Odyssey. I had one of these Pong games when I was a kid. I honestly can't remember if it was an Odyssey or not, but it was one of those that had, technically it had like six games on it, but all the games were just a variation of a paddle game. Like basketball was different because it was, everything was flipped around so that the paddles are on the bottom of the screen.
Yeah.
And you're bouncing a ball up to a little like area that is designated as the goal,
the hoop.
Yeah. But Nintendo didn't make the Odyssey. They were just the Japanese distributors, but they saw that it ended up being very popular with their customers. And they thought, maybe we'll get into this market ourselves.
Yes. And they decide to get into the market not only in Japan, but also in the US and Europe.
Yeah, they start distributing the Odyssey to those countries as well. Mm-hmm. The very first arcade game that Nintendo tends to cite as the first one that they made, there's some contention about this, and there's a lot of confusion. When it comes to video games, people did not take very good notes.
Yeah.
Because when you start talking about the history of any of these companies and you start talking about their earliest games, there's a lot of disagreement about what really counts. But the one that they typically say was their first arcade game was a title called EVR Race, which came out in 1975. There were technically two different versions of this. One of them was a game in which you were betting on a horse race. The other was a game where you were betting on a car race, and you would decide which of the participants you were going to bet on. They each had their own little area where you would put your coin. Essentially, you're placing a bet. It was called EVR because the technology was electronic video recorder technology, sort of a predecessor to VHS.
Or maybe like real plumbers don't wear ties. No.
No. So it was a predecessor
to VHS.
That's
not even a Nintendo game.
So the idea here was that they had all these different scenarios of a race that had all been pre-filmed. There's just like let's say that there's eight horses in your racing game and you filmed 128 different outcomes of the race.
Poor horses.
I think the horse race one was all animated. So.
All right.
But you've done 128 different variations. And so sometimes horse number one comes in first place, sometimes second, sometimes third, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of those outcomes are predetermined. What isn't predetermined is which version of the race is going to run on any given playthrough. So you put your coin in and you hope that the playthrough where your horse wins is the one that comes up.
So they're still really in the gambling game.
Yeah, and you have no control over this, right? Like you aren't controlling anything on the screen. It reminds me in a way, you remember the game Dragon's Lair?
I do.
That was a Laserdisc game where you would have moments where you could put an input in, which was usually left, right, or a button.
It was like a choose-your-own-adventure book, because then you'd get the next predetermined based on your choice.
Right. So you're not controlling the character moment to moment. You are putting in an input in between animations. This was sort of the similar thing, except even less player interaction. But it still counts as their first arcade game.
It does. And I'm glad you explained it, because I did have the question of whether or not they had like two videos. It could be one or the other.
No.
It's, or it's just one video, and yeah. It always has the same outcome. You can only play the game once.
Typically, it was enough variation so that you could conceivably get each of the outcomes possible. So, of course, the more horses are in the game, the more outcomes are possible.
I see. Well, in 1976, they start upping their video game and introducing microprocessors in their consoles.
Yeah, which is a pretty big deal. Like, this mm-hmm. was the microprocessor age was just starting to get to a point where you could have things in entertainment applications, not just some of the earliest personal computers that were coming out.
Yeah.
They partnered with Mitsubishi in 1977 to create a series of consoles. The series of consoles, the English translation is Color TV Game. That was what they were called.
All right.
And they were very simple little consoles. And the first two were the most popular. The first one was called TV Game 6, and the second one was called TV Game 15, which sounds confusing, except then you realize the 6 and 15 refer to the number of variations of games that were mm-hmm. available on those consoles. They, again, were mostly paddle-based games, so 6 different versions of Pong and 15 different versions of Pong.
I'm really glad they have the TV Game 15, because 6 versions is not enough, Jonathan.
Yeah, I know. I need to play Pong 15 different ways.
And then they make a game that's not a clay shooter or Pong. They make a tabletop Othello-type video game.
Yeah, and all the controls are buttons.
Yes.
Like, it was just buttons on there. So you would push a button to indicate what your next move was.
So it's also great if you're a fidgeter.
Yeah. 1979, they open up their Nintendo of America branch in New York.
Yes. And then in 1980, we got the Game & Watch systems, which were portable microprocessor LCD video games, mm-hmm. the first of them. Some people say it was their first breakout success. And there was an article on BBC.com that I wanted to add this, because the article on BBC.com tickled me. They said that the system was inspired by a bored businessman commuting mm-hmm. who is just punching buttons on his calculator to pass the time. You know, hopefully not spelling any naughty words on his calculator.
80085.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we've all been bored businessmen stuck on the subway at one point in our lives.
It.
So then Nintendo goes on to make a few more arcade games, but the true revolution of Nintendo would begin in 1981. They had tried to make some games and had met with some limited success and a couple of flops, mm-hmm. but then they released what I would argue is the iconic game for the early Nintendo years, which of course was Donkey Kong.
Yes.
This was a game designed by an artist who worked at Nintendo, Shigeru Miyamoto, a famous game designer.
Yes.
Father of Mario. And the company had previously tried to sell a different arcade game called Radar Scope. And you actually found out what Radar Scope was like.
Yeah, it was sort of a mix between Space Invaders and Galaxian, mm-hmm. which I don't know how that failed, because I love both Space Invaders and Galaxian.
It's possible that it was just that the other titles already
existed,
had that space. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they weren't able to move these Radar Scope games. They had made too many of them. Not enough arcades wanted one. So because this was the arcade era. We're not talking about video game consoles yet.
Yes.
So to minimize their losses, the Nintendo executive said, what we're going to do is gut these cabinets of Radar Scope. Because, you know, these games were purpose-built for those specific titles. Like, they had hardware that had the game programmed on them. So it wasn't like you could just change out a chip. You had to change out the guts of the machine. But they needed to have something else to put in there. And they essentially held kind of an internal contest. And they told their employees, if you can come up with a really good idea for an arcade game, pitch it, and we'll go with that. And Miyamoto's pitch won, and that was Donkey Kong. It also introduced us to Mario, but he wasn't called Mario.
No, he was called Jumpman.
Yeah, which, accurate description based upon what he did in the game.
Yes, and, you know, Donkey Kong was a giant success,
mm-hmm.
and it led Nintendo to invest more into its arcade division.
Mm-hmm. Started putting out a lot more games.
Yes, once again, they say, okay, we found something that works. Let's really dig into it.
Mm-hmm.
They purchased manufacturing facilities, and they started the process of launching their own fully-fledged home video game console.
Yep. So this is at a time when home video games are also starting to take off, and especially in the United States. You had game systems like the Atari 2600, yes, and ColecoVision and Intellivision. So Nintendo wants to get in on that too. And their system in Japan is called Famicom, which is sort of a portmanteau of family and computer. But everywhere else, it would end up being called Nintendo Entertainment System. It did not have a direct A to B journey to that name, however. It got a little complicated. So it launched in Japan in July of 1983, and the Japanese version of the Nintendo, the Famicom, was a white and red. So if you've ever seen a picture of a Nintendo and it looks totally weird because it's this white and red color, that's the Japanese version, the original Japanese version.
I see the picture of it and my brain immediately goes to that 70s show. I know it's came out in the 80s, but it's got that ultimate retro feel to
it. Yeah, yeah. And the first three games that were available when the system launched were Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., and Popeye.
Oh. That makes sense.
Yeah. Nintendo made all the arcade game versions of those as well. So these were arcade game ports to the home video game system. That first year, they only released 10 titles for the Famicom, but it was a hit in Japan. So then they started to look at expanding overseas. But that would end up being a little bit of a problem because...
because in the U.S., the gaming industry was not doing well.
No.
No. They were having what was called the video game crash of 1983.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I was too young to remember this.
Because way to twist the knife, Ariel.
Broken my poor little geek heart. Now, it was called the Atari crash in Japan. And
which is pretty fitting.
Pretty fitting. And pretty finger-pointing, too.
Well, and it made sense because Atari was the dominant company that was involved in this.
They held like 80% of the market at the time.
Video game crash of 1983, you might be wondering what exactly caused this enormous crash. And it was actually several factors that all kind of happened together. One was that there were way too many game systems out there on the market. So at this point, you were in the what people called the second generation of home video game consoles. The Atari 2600 belongs to the second generation. The first generation would be all those consoles that played variations of Pong, like the Odyssey.
Yes.
But you also had the Coleco Telstar in those days. Those were games where the games were directly programmed on the console itself, so you couldn't change them out. There were no cartridges or discs or anything like that. Then you had the second generation of video game consoles. This is when the manufacturer said, we can design it so that the games are on a cartridge and then you plug the cartridge into the console and that way you can decide which games you want for your system. We won't have it pre-programmed on there. You can actually say, oh, well, I don't care about a racing game, so I'm not going to buy that. But I do want to get this platform game that's like Donkey Kong. I want that one.
Which also makes it a lot more accessible to home audiences because you don't have to have five giant cabinets in your house if you want to play five different video games.
Yes. Although you do get into the argument of who gets to play next, because not all the games were two-player, and not everyone had two controls for their systems. But
that's still the problem sometimes today.
Yeah. No, my wife gets real greedy with the Xbox. So that was one of the things, was just that there were just too many consoles out there. You had the Atari, the Intellivision, the ColecoVision. You had all these other cheap consoles that were coming out. So getting into that crowded marketplace was already a problem. Secondly, Nintendo specifically pointed this one out. A lot of these consoles weren't locked down in the sense that anyone who had the access to manufacturing could make a game for these systems. They weren't licensed.
I wouldn't think that many people would have access to specifically video game manufacturing, but apparently a lot of people did.
Yeah. Well, you ended up getting like all these little companies that would hire developers to crank games out at a crazy pace and just rush them through even just medium-sized production runs
yeah.
to try and get more and more games out to market.
And they skimped on the QA.
Yeah, big time. Or they didn't even have QA.
Yeah,
so on top of that, then you had the big guns like Atari making these risky moves. The one that everyone tends to think about is how Atari would spend huge amounts of money licensing popular culture titles to turn them into games, do so very quickly, have a really lousy translation of mm-hmm. that pop culture title, and then make way too many of them. There's a famous story that when they got the license to make Pac-Man, they made more Pac-Man cartridges than there were Atari 2600 consoles. And
wow.
the concept was that Pac-Man would sell more consoles. It would be a console killer. Like, that's the killer app. It didn't work out that way because that game was crap.
Yeah.
The Atari 2600 version of Pac-Man is terrible.
Apparently, Atari has a giant burial ground somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. They really did. There's a whole documentary about it. Yeah, the famous title was E.T. That was the one where they spent a huge amount of money on E.T. I had that game, by the way, for the Atari 2600.
I bet it wasn't very good.
It wasn't as bad as what some people have said, but it was bad enough for it to be a major contributing factor to this video game crash.
But you know, I can understand Atari making all of these decisions because they do have 80% of the market. So yeah.
They felt that they were too big to fail.
Yeah.
And the problem was they weren't. They overcommitted on this side and they weren't able to recover when the market began to crash because consumers were rejecting video games. There are too many crappy titles on the market. No one was sure what was good or worth buying or what wasn't. And people just stopped doing it. And there was too much product that just wasn't selling.
Yeah, they started to do what you did and went to personal computers.
Yeah, yeah, that was essentially the move in the United States. And so Nintendo had unfortunately chosen exactly that time to really try and get into the video game console market. So they recognized that there was no way they were going to just stroll into the United States and say, hey, we've got a video game console. You know, that thing that nobody wants anymore. So they had to come up with a strategy. And we'll explain what that was and how a little robot named Rob played an important part. But first, let's take another quick break.
So as we said before the break, Nintendo does a bit of homework because they know these toy companies don't want to carry a product that nobody wants. And they know that a big problem people had with video game systems at the time was quality control, these horrible, horrible games, mm-hmm. as we said. So instead of having their systems unlocked, they had a microchip that companies would have to get permissions. They'd have to license from Nintendo to make games for their system.
Yeah, it was essentially a system where Nintendo would have a seal of approval. And that's the only way companies would be allowed to sell a game on the system.
But even that wasn't enough to get retailers to carry them because they had been burnt.
Exactly, yeah. They had just gone through a system where they had all this product on their shelves that wasn't moving. And then you had companies going out of business, which meant that the companies that had manufactured that stuff couldn't buy it back from the store. So the stores had just mostly taken a big loss on this. So there wasn't a whole lot of incentive to get back into it.
Yeah. Then Nintendo decides to focus on the Consumer Electronics Show, CES, in 1985. And they tried to give their console a little bit of a makeover.
Oh, yeah, no.
They turned it gray and they called it the Advanced Video System.
Yeah, the idea being that they wanted to make it look more like a personal computer because that market was doing all right in the United States. So they thought, well, if we position this system like it's a computer, then maybe we can get retailers to carry it. And so it had all these different peripherals, like keyboards and stuff.
But instead of being a really great personal computer or a really great video system, it was just a kind kind of confused middle space.
Yeah, so no one bid on that. Mm-hmm. But Nintendo was not going to give up. They still had another show to hit later that year, 6 months later.
Yes, the summer CES show.
They're back again.
And this time they're like, okay, personal computer was not the right choice.
Yeah.
So yes, this is an entertainment system. We admit it. We give up.
But the interesting thing to me, though, is they don't call it a video game system. They call it an entertainment system. The idea being that this isn't about playing games. This is bigger than that. It reminds me a lot, a few years ago, Microsoft did the same thing with the Xbox, where they weren't just focusing on the fact that it plays video games. They started talking about, this is going to act like a DVR. It lets you watch television. It lets you use all these different apps that are compatible with the Xbox. They were really positioning the Xbox as a full entertainment system. Nintendo did the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just Nintendo did it 30 years earlier.
Yes. And then because it's this entertainment system, it's not a console. It's bigger and better than that. They develop a little toy.
Yeah, for a peripheral. Yeah.
Called ROB.
Which stands for Robotic Operating Buddy.
Yes. And your robotic operating buddy would play with you with certain games.
Yeah. It had light sensors in its eyes. And when certain light patterns would hit the sensors, it would activate some action for Rob.
Yeah. I bet Rob was just gunning for those ducks. Those Duck Hunt ducks.
I think there were only two games ever released in the United States that worked with Rob, and Duck Hunt was not one of them.
I mean, it's kind of cheating.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody who plays Duck Hunt cheats. You put the gun right up to the TV.
Yeah, and you just pull the trigger and then it's fine.
Yeah.
It just makes me think that if we had done it, that if Rob had worked with that, it would have been like releasing the Terminator on those poor ducks and really, that dog.
I really want to see someone retrofit it now and to do that.
So they decide they're going to push for this again. Retailers were still not entirely convinced, mm-hmm. even at this point. So Nintendo decides they're going to do a soft launch in the United States. They're not going to go nationwide first thing. Instead, they are going to focus on just a small little market, a teeny tiny little market, New York City.
I have to deviate here for a brief second, because this actually was a smart decision on their part.
Yeah.
But they didn't give it up. And recently, in the past few years, they came out with the NES
Classic.
Classic Mini and the SNES Classic Mini, both of which they still did the small batch, despite overwhelming interest in them. And you couldn't get them anywhere. And it drove me crazy.
I have an NES Mini.
I have an SNES Mini now.
Yeah.
Because they've made them more available lately, but it made me so angry.
I was just lucky because the Amazon treasure truck had the classic NES one day, and I ran out and I got it.
Lucky.
Because I couldn't find it anywhere else. So Nintendo still follows this philosophy occasionally of making these small production runs, which is kind of funny. But I mean, it comes down to the company saying, like, we didn't know how much demand there was going to be, but then they don't, they usually have moved on to building something else.
Yeah.
Like, you need physical manufacturing facilities to make these things.
Yes.
And when they switch over to something else, it's not easy to switch back and just make another batch.
I would wager to say they probably knew for the NES and SNES by the time they were making their second and third batches, but back in October 15 of 1985, they didn't.
Yeah. So they make a small batch for New York City. And even then, as they're going to retailers in New York, they're still encountering resistance. The retailers are still feeling like this is too big a risk. So they decide that they will sweeten the deal.
And how did they do that, Jonathan?
Well, they did it by taking on a huge amount of risk themselves. Typically, the way retail works, for those who don't know, is that if you run a retail establishment, you purchase stock from a manufacturer at the lower price. Mm-hmm. And then you sell it at a markup in your store. And the profit is obviously the difference between the markup price and whatever you paid for it from the manufacturer. These retailers didn't want to pay any money for these systems. They were convinced nothing was going to happen. So the president of Nintendo America, which was Minoru Arakawa, who was son-in-law of Hiroshi Yamauchi, so still keeping in the family through marriage, Arakawa says, here's what we're going to do. we will set up displays in your store. Nintendo will pay for that. We will design the display. We'll set them up in your stores. And we won't charge you for stock. You can carry our systems. And any systems you sell, then we charge you. But if you don't sell any, you don't pay for anything. And then if they don't get moved, we'll take the consoles back.
So it's kind of a no-lose situation.
Yeah, the retailers have, there's no risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because all they're doing is really giving up some space in their stores. So the retailers say, all right, well, I can't think of any reasonable purpose I should object to this. Go ahead, build your displays, put your stock in my store. If we sell any, I'll pay you.
Sadly, it still didn't pick up.
It didn't go crazy. It wasn't like an instant success.
No, they sold about half of their systems manufactured for the holiday season.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's also because New York is a difficult market to sell in.
Yeah, in fact, it was considered to be one of the toughest markets in the United States. But, you know, they say if you can make it there,
you can make it anywhere.
It's up to you, New York.
New York.
Yeah, that was actually why they did that. And so while they were only able to sell half of the consoles they made, they didn't get out to the market until October, and they were aiming specifically for the holiday season. They had it in a limited region with very little marketing behind it.
And different titles than their Japanese market.
Yeah, they didn't come out with Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., and Popeye for the American release. In fact, some of those games, it would take several months before they would come out.
I mean, you still hear people complain about not being able to get Japanese versions.
Oh, yeah.
Of the game.
So the titles they launched with included Duck Hunt, Kung Fu, and Ice Climber, and about seven or eight more titles.
I love Ice Climber.
I like Kung Fu.
I don't think I've played Kung Fu.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a great game. It's a side-scroller game. It's really, I played that in the arcades, and I really liked the Nintendo version. I didn't own a Nintendo, but a friend of mine, Brian, owned one.
I super used my neighbor's Nintendos, and then I babysat someone for a while, and I used their SNES.
Yeah.
We played a lot of Mario.
Well, the company saw promise in the United States, even though the first run was not a slam dunk, and they went ahead and went forward with the decision to expand into a few other cities starting in 1986. So a lot of people trace Nintendo's initial real push in the U.S. to 1986. Mm-hmm. They don't really count 85 because it was sort of a pilot program.
Yeah.
So 86 tends to be when people say Nintendo really got started in America.
Well, that's around the time we got Super Mario Brothers as well.
Yeah, there's some, again, disagreement about when it came out, whether it was 85 or 86. And I honestly could not find a definitive source that would nail that down for us. You would think you would be able to figure that stuff out, but no.
But yeah, it is pretty definitive that that is one of the games that made Nintendo as successful as it is.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a reason why Mario became Nintendo's mascot.
Yeah, and they wanted him to be in everything possible.
Yeah, and he pretty much is.
Yes.
Yeah, so Super Mario Brothers would become a console killer app. It was selling. It was what Pac-Man was supposed to be for the Atari 2600. And it was just a huge success from that point forward. The NES sold so well that today it ranks somewhere around number 12 for best-selling video game consoles of all time.
Wow.
And keep in mind, it had come out after a video game crash and before the current wave of video games being more mainstream. At that time, video games were still kind of a niche market, but it had some lasting power, and it was able to become the 12th best-selling console in history. Nintendo also has several other systems that are in the top 10.
Yeah.
The DS is number 2. So if you count handheld systems, Nintendo DS is only behind the PlayStation 2. PlayStation 2 is number 1, and then it's Nintendo DS.
Well, and then they also have the third best, which is Game Boy, which is also handheld, which came out right after the NES.
Yeah, they tend to group Game Boy and Game Boy Color together because it's essentially the same system.
Mm-hmm.
So those get lumped in together. The Wii is number 5 on best-selling game consoles, and the Game Boy Advance is number 10. And Switch is doing quite well, too.
Yeah.
So that kind of brings us through that. I would say the brink moment was really when Nintendo made the decision that we're really going to pursue making video games and, you know, arcade games and video game systems, and really when they made the commitment to go beyond the Japanese market.
Yes, yes, despite knowing their odds.
Yeah.
We're going to super fast forward because there's still important stuff to talk about, including future Brink moments.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've released a lot of consoles.
Some of which did really well and some of which did not do so well.
Yeah, the SNES did really well.
Yeah, that was from 8-bits to 16-bits. So the NES was an 8-bit system. SNES was 16-bit system.
Yes, and that launched in 1990. We also got the Nintendo 64, the GameCube, the Wii, the unfortunate Wii U.
Yeah, which did not do well.
And the Switch.
Yeah. Wii U was probably the closest they've had to a flop, right?
I would disagree with you. I would say that would be the Virtual Boy.
Oh, sure. The Virtual Boy. Yeah, I didn't think about the Virtual. I try not to think about the Virtual Boy because just remembering the
makes
Virtual Boy
makes you motion sick
and gives me a headache.
Yeah.
I would get terrible headaches when I tried playing it.
I will say the Wii U did not do well. It was a valiant effort, but it didn't do well. The Virtual Boy is the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
It was discontinued after a year.
The Nintendo Power Glove was also not a great peripheral,
but it made a great movie.
Was that The Wizard?
I think so.
With Fred Savage?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the Power Glove, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Power Glove was in that one. I have never seen that movie. I just know it from the pop culture references.
Listen.
Yeah, so the one thing that I think is really interesting is that I don't believe we would have the video game console landscape that we have today without the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Certainly not.
That NES was able to reinvigorate an industry that had gone into a total tailspin. You know, the video game crash in 1983 was seriously a terrible thing. It killed the industry.
It did, yeah.
And the fact that Nintendo was able to revive it is what set the stage for other companies like Sony and Microsoft to get in and find success. And to a lesser extent, some of the other companies that saw some success but ultimately couldn't stick it out, like Sega.
Yeah. Now, we talked about the Wii U not doing great, and I sometimes wonder, because around that time, they struggled a bit.
Mm-hmm.
They had been struggling for a bit. And I wonder if it was because the systems weren't that great or because they weren't releasing that many games that people had to have.
Yeah. And Nintendo has largely depended upon its own intellectual property for most of its value. So stuff like the Super Mario Brothers or Zelda, the games that we associate with Nintendo that are Nintendo exclusives, those have largely been the things that have moved consoles. But that puts a lot of pressure just on Nintendo, the company.
It does.
And there are only maybe a handful of titles that didn't come straight from Nintendo that are sort of iconic titles on Nintendo systems. GoldenEye, I would say, is one of those.
Yeah. But, I mean, around the time of Wii U, one of the reasons we didn't purchase it is because there just weren't any games we really wanted.
Yeah.
They weren't coming out with their own blockbuster titles or releasing other blockbuster titles.
It was such a clever game system design, and it is a shame that it didn't have the titles to help support it.
Because
I got to play the Wii U before it had come out. It was behind closed doors at a CES the year before it would come to market in the U.S. And we even played essentially a variation of Pac-Man. And it was interesting because the person controlling Pac-Man was looking down at the Wii U pad. So they're using it like a tablet, and they're able to see the whole maze and where Pac-Man is. For the people playing the ghosts, they were seeing the view as if it was a first-person view inside the maze.
That is pretty cool.
So your perspective depended upon which role you were playing. So that was just a neat idea. Recently, very recently, Nintendo's president, Shuntaro Furukawa, the current president of Nintendo, hinted that Nintendo might actually be getting out of the video game console market. Forbes had a report in which they included this quote, and here's a direct quote. "It has been over 30 years since we started developing consoles. Nintendo's history goes back even farther than that. And through all the struggles that they faced, the only thing they thought about was what to make next. In the long term, perhaps our focus as a business could shift away from home consoles. Flexibility is just as important as ingenuity. Now, that doesn't say that they're, it says long term. So first of all, in the short term, we're probably not going to see very much change.
They'll probably try their hand at a bunch of things before they really take a jump.
Yeah, but this is, I think it's pretty wise. It's saying, listen, we've been in this space before where the playing card space, we were hitting market saturation. It was getting harder and harder to make an impact. The same thing could be true with video game consoles, especially as we're seeing more, we're kind of seeing another swing toward PC gaming these days. Not that people have abandoned consoles, but I've just, you know, you kind of notice these cycles where video game consoles start getting really popular and PC gaming starts to kind of go into the background and then it'll shift again. And we're at a point right now where I would argue PC gaming is taking prominence over video game consoles.
I would agree. Maybe they could get into biohacking next.
So they have Nintendo products that allow you to jump and hit blocks and get coins.
Yes. A new way of banking.
Couple of other things that we want to wrap up with before we leave. First of all, I love that you have this report about how many games Mario's been in.
Yes. Over 200.
Over
200
games. Not necessarily as the lead character.
No, I mean, he was in Donkey Kong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As Jumpman.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's that. The Nintendo is still, to this day, producing Hanafuda decks.
Yes.
They haven't gotten out of that business. They still do it in Japan.
Yes. The original NES, as we said, it's still number 12. It sold over 40 million units.
That's a lot.
Yeah. That is.
I mean, these days we're looking at a really super successful console, more than 100 million. But when you think about the time that it came out.
Yeah.
You know, and its lifespan was essentially in the U.S., it was essentially 1986 to 1990, because that's when the SNES came out.
Yeah, and then so, you only get people who are retro collectors wanting it.
Yeah, and often they're just buying used ones, which means you're not adding to that overall number. Mm-hmm.
But you have the best fun fact of them all, Jonathan.
So this broke while we were getting ready to record this podcast. The longtime president of Nintendo America, a guy named Reggie Fils-Aimé, announced that he's going to retire.
Aww.
So he's been around doing these things. I've seen him in person at E3 in the past.
Mm-hmm.
He's retiring. Taking his place is a guy named Doug Bowser.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah, if you're a Mario fan, you know Bowser is the bad guy.
Do, 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 do.
So it's the end of times. And on that note, it is time for us to say goodbye. Where can they reach us, Ariel?
Well, if you want to reach us to tell us your favorite Nintendo video game or ask us a question or suggest a topic for a future episode, you can do so at feedback@thebrinkpodcast.show.
Yes, and if you want to visit our website, that's thebrinkpodcast.show. We've got our archive there and a little bit about who we are and why we're here.
Yes.
Sometimes I have to read it just to remind myself.
Oh.
Yeah. But no, this has been a fun one. We've got some other great topics coming up that are all suggested by listeners.
Yes.
So we're going to be recording some episodes in the near future that are all based on listener suggestions. So
it's
we thank you
exciting.
For that. Yeah, it's great because it tells us what you want to hear and we get to learn new stories and then pass them on to you. So we're looking forward to that. So keep your ears out for those. And until next time, I have been Jonathan Strickland.
And I have been Ariel Kasten. The Brink is a production of iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.